you'll see how it goes. So thank you very much for coming. I've taught Danielle twice. Well, the whole book once at Shari Shemayim a few years ago, and then in a mini-series at Kila Shari Torah on Bayview, I taught the first few chapters. And it's a sort of book that you can do in a lot of different ways. It lends itself to discussion. Like, we could end up spending all 6 weeks just on the first chapter if we wanted to do that. Or you can read it just as a sefer, as a text, and go, you know, straight through. And in that case, obviously, you cover more ground. But I'm fine either way. It's really going to be your call in terms of how this develops. So I'm going to take my cue from the way people engage with it. I think you're all on the email list from that I got from Hadassah, so I'll be sending out the sheets in advance and following up with the with the link to the audio. In the event that you have a question that we didn't get to in the class, it's fine to email me afterwards, and I'll be glad to continue discussions that way. Danielle is a great book. Someone said to me that they never really covered. I think Hadassah, you had said to me that someone said that it's not something that people really learn. There are a lot of reasons for that. Number one, half the book's in Aramaic, which can be intimidating. Although, as you'll see, the Aramaic is actually pretty close to Hebrew. It's not that hard to get what's going on. But that's one reason. Another reason is because the first half is sort of classic Bible story, if you will. Danielle in the Lion's Den is one that people know. The handwriting on the wall is another one that people may be familiar with. And so people sort of learn it that way and never revisit it on a more sophisticated level to see it as it appears in the Sefer, in the book itself. And then the second half is, I don't mean this in too glib a way, but nearly unintelligible. Meaning the second half of the book is just incredibly hard to read, and you'll see why if we get to that point. 6 weeks, unlikely, but we'll see. There's a lot here within the book. There are the classic stories. But more than that, Danielle's a sefer which speaks to the Jew in North America today in particular. Hadassah mentioned Yom HaShoah, and it's stunning to realize how the Jewish community of North America, growing as it did after the Shoah, was present here and more in the U.S. before, but growing since then has become such an influential community. And even though we talk about now issues, what is the future of the Jewish community, growth of anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, and so on, nonetheless, we are in a fantastic position compared to the position Jews have been in over time. And Danielle is someone who really is in a position that mirrors our position today, in the sense that he's right after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, the first temple. And I'm going to keep on translating things because I don't know everybody's background, so I apologize if it's insulting when I translate something. Don't be insulted. But Danielle is coming from this absolutely devastating loss where the Beit HaMikdash they've had for 410 years is demolished. Thousands upon thousands have died. More have been exiled. And they've hit rock bottom. And then on the other hand, he is in the court of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, destroyer of the Beit HaMikdash. I mean, to make the analogy perfect, it would be as though a Jew were the advisor to post-World War II, the German chancellor. Like, that's what you'd be talking about. And the ways in which he deals with being in power and the jealousy of the people around him and the question of what he can say and what he can't say to Nebuchadnezzar really speaks a lot to the questions of Jews who are in a more influential, more powerful community than we were 70 years ago, who are now in the position to wield influence. So that's really the theme of the first half of the book and why I find it to be a fascinating read. The second half has this completely different mystique to it, visions of angels and the heavens and predictions of the time of Mashiach. So there's a lot here, and there are many reasons to read it, and I hope that some of that will come across in the next 6 weeks. Little bit of an overview. This is in the section of Tanakh called Ketuvim. Right? Tanakh stands for Torah Nevi'im Ketuvim, Torah being five books, the biblical books, Nevi'im being prophets, and Ketuvim being the writings. And we're going to talk more about that in a few minutes. The Gemara says that the Anshei Knesset HaGadola are the ones who finalize the text. The Anshei Knesset HaGadola is an assembly of Chachamim, of sages, in the beginning of the second temple, second Beis HaMikdash. They're the ones who decide what makes it into Tanakh, what doesn't, and they're the ones who finalize what we see as Sefer Daniel. A little bit of history. You're familiar, I hope, with the concept of the 10 lost tribes, right? The 10 missing Shvatim. That's familiar? Okay. So the Jews come into Canaan, which becomes Israel, and spend a few centuries sort of developing their society under the Shoftim, under the judges. Then you get a Beis HaMikdash, a first temple. David HaMelech wants to build it, isn't allowed to build it. His son Shlomo builds it, and then everything falls apart. After Shlomo dies, his throne is passed to Rehoboam, his son. Rehoboam is not a great leader, and in his time, the kingdom splits. The northern kingdom is Yisrael, led by, anybody know? Yerovam ben Nevat, good. And in the south, it's led by Rehoboam. The north is called Yisrael, the south is called Yehuda. The north quickly descends. They become idolatrous, they become like the Canaanites around them, they have coups, their kings are assassinated. They become just like basically any other nation in the Middle East fairly quickly. Whereas Yehuda in the south, which includes Yerushalayim, is much more loyal. Yisrael gets exiled by the Assyrians, King Sancheriv. He takes them out. And Sancheriv's method of conquest was transfer, where he would move into a country, not just us, countries in general, and move out the local population and move in somebody else. So that's how the 10 tribes become the 10 lost tribes. The Yehuda does not succeed in conquering. There is a miracle. Yerushalayim is protected. It was actually mentioned in Vayihi B'Chatzi HaLaila, one of the songs of the Seder, mentioned it. And Yehuda continues for some time after Yisrael has been exiled, until along comes King Nebuchadnezzar of Babel. And the first time he comes through, he's not interested in destroying the Beis HaMikdash, he's not interested in destroying the Jews, he just wants to conquer us. So the king at the time is King Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim declares loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar. 3 years later, Jehoiakim decides I've had enough of being a vassal of Nebuchadnezzar, and he rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar's troops exile Jehoiakim to Babel. He goes into exile and he dies en route into exile. 11 years after Nebuchadnezzar first conquered what you could call, I suppose, Judea, he comes back. And at that point, he exiles the Jewish leadership. That's when Daniel goes into Galus. Daniel is in that group of leaders. They're known in Hebrew as the Cheresh and the Masker. They are the leaders of the Jews of the time. If you're familiar with, let me not go too far astray. The 7 years after that, Nebuchadnezzar comes back and destroys the Beis HaMikdash. So that Galus actually happens in stages. So our Sefer Daniel is going to begin in that Babylonian exile and continue after the Babylonians are gone, replaced by the Persians. So there's a regime change that goes on in between. I put on your sheet just a reference, first of all, if you want more information on the historical background, you really want to read Malachim Beis, Kings 2, as it gets translated, chapter 24. That will give you the background on what's going on that leads to this. The themes of the Sefer, of the book, are there in number 2, in chronological order of the way things happen in the book itself. So you can see the list there. You don't need me to read it aloud for you. But that's something that we're going to see elements of as we go through it. The book itself does really sound like it has two halves. So much so that if you go into the realm of critical historians and so forth, they tend to look at Daniel as two different books that were stuck together. But their read is difficult because there are so many unifying elements within the book. The Da'at Mikra, which is the edition that I have here, talks about how the numbers 4 and 7 continually emerge within the book. Sets of 4 and sets and 7 and sets of 7 come out throughout the Sefer. But you could read the first half, chapters 1 to 6, as dealing with events of the time of Daniel, and chapters 7 to 12, visions of the future with a little bit of odd overlap in the sense that sort of the events of the first half run until chapter 6, and then chapter 7 actually moves back in time a little bit into the first half. And it actually matters, which I brought you here. If you take a look at number 4 on your sheet, it explains why this book is done a little bit asynchronously, where it moves through time, and then it goes backward, and then it goes forward. If you take a look at the Medrash, I brought you there the Hebrew and the English. Belshazzar Malka, King Belshazzar, that's from the 5th chapter, V'Daryavesh Midah, and then Darius the Mede, V'Heichan Hu Evil Merodach, and the Medrash is bothered because the book of Daniel, in its first run through, goes from King Belshazzar to King Daryavesh, Darius, and it skips Evil Merodach. His name is not Evil Merodach. That's just fortunate that he ends up with that as his first name. Yeah, that's, you know, that's just luck in life. It's based on how your parents were feeling that day. They made him evil, and he was stuck with it. So the question that they ask is, Evil Merodach is missing in the first half of the book, even though we know that he reigned in between. That's what the Medrash is bothered by. So Eliezer Amar Kadei Lismo Rasha El Rasha Kotzeitz Le Kotzeitz Givyasan or Gaivasan Le Gaivasan. And Rabbi Eliezer's answer is that this is done thematically because Belshazzar and Darius are terrible kings and we want to put them side by side because they're really horrible people. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman Amar Kadei Lismo Hefsek Malchus Le Hefsek Malchus. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman explains it's because both Belshazzar and Darius have their monarchies interrupted in the sense that Belshazzar is the last Babylonian king and then they're conquered by the Persians. Medes / Persians. And then Darius is king for almost a year, and then his reign is interrupted, which we'll talk about if we get to Darius in this. So it's trying to just juxtapose the two in order to show these are two kings whose reigns were cut off. And then it continues to say, with the Kavasa, similarly, the verse actually says in Daniel, that night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, which is a word we're going to have to come back to, but he was killed, and Darius the Mede. But then later on it says, it's going to say in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. And what bothers them is the fact that Belshazzar is going to go back to Belshazzar chronologically. In other words, it's talking about Belshazzar. He gets killed. Darius arises. And then it goes back to talk about a vision Daniel has in the time of Belshazzar. So how am I supposed to understand the order of things? To which Rav Huna Amar, Rav Huna answers, he says, and this is the key line to me, that this is done in order that people should know that this was written with Ruach HaKodesh, with divine inspiration. It's not simply piyutim, it's not simply poetry, this book. It's done in order to show you that there's a purpose to everything, there's a structure to it. In other words, if someone tells a story in order, A, B, C, D, E. So we assume it's a storybook. It's a history book. Once you start playing with chronology, you understand that there's something going on. The author / editor is trying to convey a message. Why else would you have changed the order? Think about the rule in Chumash, right? In Muktam Aluchar BaTorah. The idea that there's neither before nor after in the Torah. So every time we see something in the Torah and say, well, wait, that doesn't seem to fit, we have to ask, then why is it there? Right? Classic example from Chumash Bereishis, the sale of Yosef. Right? If you remember the way the story plays out, Yosef is sold by his brothers, and then he shows up in Egypt, and the story with Potiphar, his wife, and so on. Right? But in the middle, after Yosef is sold, and before we read about the incident with Potiphar's wife, there's another story stuck into the Chumash. What story is put there in the middle? Yehuda and Tamar. Right? That's a story that's stuck right in the middle, after Yosef is sold, and before Yosef and the whole incident with Potiphar's wife. Well, how long does the story of Yehuda and Tamar take? Consider this. I didn't do that, right?
Okay. And don't worry, someone is with her.
Okay. So Yehuda, if you think about the story, right, Yehuda gets married. Yehuda and his wife have 3 children, who grow up to be old enough that the first one is able to himself get married to Tamar, die. The second one marries Tamar, dies. The third one He chooses not to give to Tamar. And then Tamar gets impatient with waiting. And then Tamar is with Yehuda. And then Tamar is pregnant and is ready to give birth. And that entire story in which two generations of a family develop is all within the span between when Yosef is sold and the span when this thing happens with Potiphar's wife. That's really difficult because we know how long Yosef is in Egypt, right? We know that Yosef is sold when he's 17. We know that Yosef stands in front of Paro when he is 30. You don't have a whole lot of time, right, for that to happen. We know that because we also know that he's 39 ultimately when his family comes down, and that's after 7 years of plenty and 2 years of famine. So you have what, 13 years for Yehuda to get married, for he and his wife to have three kids, for them to grow up such that the oldest one is able to get married and then die, and the second one can get married, it doesn't fit. So the Gemara talks about, well, maybe if this one was 8 years old when he got married, and can you have a child at that age? And the bottom line is, in Mokdem HaMukhar Batara, there's no order of things in the Chumash. The reason the story is put there is, as Rashi explains, in order to teach me a lesson about how Yehuda conducted himself with Tamar, versus how Yosef conducted himself with Potiphar's wife. It's meant to show that, as well as to show Yehuda's descent, because Yehuda was honored among the brothers, he failed to save Yosef, and therefore the next section begins, Vayere Yehuda Me'ezechav, Yehuda descends, because they demote him, essentially. Like, we're all going to blame him for not convincing us not to sell Yosef, thanks. We won't demote ourselves, we're just going to demote Yehuda. So, that's what you're seeing here, and that's what this medrash is trying to say, that the chronology is going to be a little bit off within the book itself, and it's done that way in order to tell you this book is intentional, its structure is intentional. It's not just a history book. It's trying to teach us ideas, lessons, things that we can then use. You follow? Okay. So that's a little bit about the chronology within the book. There's a language barrier within the book. I mentioned before that almost half the book is in Aramaic. Basically, it's the first half of the book, the fun part, that's in it. Why would they use Aramaic?
Because it's the language they spoke.
That's the language they spoke. So therefore, every book written at that time should be in Aramaic, right? I mean, we have three Nevi'im from the first generations of the second Beis Hamikdash when the Jews are all speaking Aramaic. And we know that they're speaking Aramaic because they had kelim, they had vessels in the Beis Hamikdash that had to have markings on them. And the Gemara informs us that when they came back for the second Beis Hamikdash, they actually wrote the names of the labels of each of these vessels in Aramaic because the Jews were weak in terms of their Hebrew at that time. So I would have expected, if that's the way we write Tanakh in whatever language people are speaking, then the three prophets of those first generations, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, should also be in Aramaic. None of them are. So clearly, we don't have a rule in general of writing Tanakh in the language that people speak. So then the question is, why is Daniel in Aramaic? So take a look.
Why is everybody else speaking?
They are speaking Aramaic, but we don't generally record Aramaic for that period of time. So so Abar Benel offers us two explanations, one of which I brought here in source number 5. Then Isaac Abarbanel, and he's also somebody for whom the book of Daniel really resonates. You know a little bit about Abarbanel? The one thing people know is that they generally don't like to read him because he writes at such length. Yeah. You can be there forever reading Abarbanel. And his style is also not a popular style. His style tends to be to open a section by asking 10, 12, 15 questions. And then I'm going to preface this and I'm going to eventually get to an answer, an idea that's going to answer all of those questions that by now you have totally forgotten because, you know, there are 10, 12, or 15 questions. It can be a very hard read, but the book of Daniel is important for him because Abarbanel lives in the end of the 15th century in Spain. He was known as the Nesher HaGadol. This is what happens when you come lay hips next to the rabbi. The role that Abarbanel plays for the Jews in Spain at the end of the 15th century is he's really their protector. He's a member of the king's court. He was really a trusted higher up financially within the government, and he is the ultimate, I suppose, court Jew in that sense. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, in his writing, calls him the Nesher Hagadol, the great. Well, we usually render Nesher how?
Eagle,
right? It's actually not. Nesher is a vulture. But it's so much nicer to say eagle, because we think of, like, in Parashas Yisro, when we're promised that Hashem is going to carry us on Kanfei Nisharim, which, on the wings of eagles, sounds so much nicer than on the wings of vultures. But yeah, based on Rashi's description of the toes of the Nesher, we know it's actually a scavenger. It's a, it's a vulture. There's actually one Chumash. I think it's the Sansino Chumash. It's not the Art Scroll, because Art Scroll just likes to translate species names with the Hebrew word. So the translation in Art Scroll for Nesher is N-E-S-E-H-E-R. I think it's the Sansino Chumash. In the list of kosher and non-kosher birds, well, it's only a list of non-kosher birds, it translates Nesher as vulture. But in Parshas Yisro, when it says, I'm going to carry you out, Akanfei Nesharim, it says on the wings of eagles. Which, I'm kind of grateful for, on the whole. But in any case, the Beis Yosef only means the nicest thing. When he calls Abarbanel the Nesher HaGadol, he was a great protector of the Jews at the time, until 1492, when the Jews get expelled from Spain, and Abarbanel is powerless to stop the expulsion. And he is devastated, and he goes into exile, and they actually want him to stay. Oh, you don't have to go with the rest of the Jews, you're a good Jew. You can remain. He doesn't want to remain. They kidnap his son. There's a whole terrible saga for Abarbanel. But for him, Sefer Daniel is critical, because he is a Jew who lived in the king's palace, who tried to defend the Jews, and who succeeded for a while and then failed. So this book has a lot of meaning for Daniel. There are more reasons for Abarbanel. There are more reasons for it, but let's take a look at what he has in number 5. Abarbanel writes to explain why this is in Aramaic. He says, Ha'omnam. Kiapshat Nirolomer, should Daniel Kasav Vilishono Hakadosh, Hakadamas Hasefer Visofo, Lufisha Yuadvarm Divrei Atzmo Leamo, Vidivrei Hamalach Elav. He says Daniel writes the introduction, the beginning of the book, as well as the whole end of the book, in Hebrew, Lashon Hakadosh, sacred tongue. He writes that because either it's him addressing the Jews, or it's the Malach, the angel, who's going to speak to him, as we'll see. So therefore he records it in Hebrew. V'nichtivu acher kach k'mo shenamru ki l'shoneinu hakadosh hu alashon shedibra kadosh baruch hu la'adam u'la'avos u'la'moshe u'la'neviav. And he's going to write it in Hebrew because that's the language that God uses when he speaks to us, and that's the language that's appropriate for Tanakh. Ubo gam ken mishtam shen malachei asharis, and that's the language that the angels use, which is a whole other discussion, k'mo shezachu chazal. But the words of the Kazdim, Chaldeans, which we're going to identify Chaldeans with Babylonians here. If you want to get technical within history, they're actually two different regions representing two different populations. Right. So the Chaldeans are actually further, I'm going to get my maps mixed up, further west than the Babylonians. Babylonians are more Tigris-Euphrates. But he mixes them together, and people generally do mix them together. When he says it, he doesn't mean to draw any distinction. So he says, when Daniel records what the Chaldeans said and their kings said, Shneru b'lashon Aramaic, those were said in Aramaic in the first place. V'gam divrei Daniel shedibur aleihem gam kein b'lashon kazdim, and the things that Daniel said were also in their language. Daniel spoke in their language. He didn't speak to them in Hebrew and have a translator. So Ra'al HaKosvam K'moshe Namru. So he recorded it as it was originally spoken. L'vishe Behetei Kadver Milashon El Lashon Acher Yipol HaTa'us V'ashgi'a Bofanim Rabin. Because he says translation is terrible. That's the bottom line. And it's true. There's no such thing as a real translation, whether you're dealing with Torah or anything else. Because words always have meaning in their native tongue that they won't have when you translate, because you can't carry over all of the meanings with it. So he says, let me write it in the original. Yeah, the problem is when you're talking to readers who don't know the original. That's so good. You carried over all of the meaning, and no one knows what you're talking about. Okay.
Why can't you say that the original?
Yeah,
the question of why the other Nevi'im don't get it recorded that way. So in Daniel's mind, in Abarbanel's view, Chagai Zachariah Malachi must have spoken Hebrew to the nation. That's how we'll have to assume. Then, granted that people's Hebrew wasn't great, that's the language that they spoke. And their language was so not great. Actually, I brought you the wrong example, come to think of it, to show you how poor the language was. The best example of it is the Rambam's version of how davening came to be. Right? The Rambam writes in the beginning of Hachos Tefillah, the laws of davening. He says, originally, there was no mitzvah of say these words whatsoever. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola, this great assembly of sages in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, were the ones who said, here's your text for Shmona Esrei. And the reason they said it was because people didn't have the Hebrew to be able to say to God what they wanted to say, and this was a minimum. Shmona Esrei was designed to be the minimum that a person should say to God, and then you can add whatever you want in your own language. And so that's Abarbanel's explanation initially. Now later in the book he actually offers a second explanation, perhaps because 70 pages later he forgot what he said in the beginning. No. But he suggests maybe it's because the first half of the book is during these periods of the Aramaic speaking empires. The visions that he has in the second half of the book are not meant to become reality until those Aramaic speaking empires are gone. Those are meant to be fulfilled, depending on who you read, in 1500s, or in our own day, or some point in the future, whatever it is. But Aramaic's not the language then anymore anyway. So therefore he transitions from Aramaic to Hebrew. You follow? That's the second explanation. Okay, that's just a little bit of history and information about the book. In terms of Daniel himself... In terms of Daniel himself, we don't get a whole lot of information. We're going to find out in the beginning of the Sefer that he's from the tribe of Yehuda, and that he is royalty. But we don't know who his parents are. We don't know where he grew up. He just shows up in Bavel. We don't know when he was born. Therefore, we don't know his age in the Sefer. Except that we're going to see in the book that he's described as a youth at the beginning of the Sefer. So, you know, youth. Well, you know, to me, youth can mean 40, right? We all define youth as we choose. But he's described as a youth at the start of the Sefer. We don't get a whole lot of other information. We don't know when he dies. The book is not going to record his death. Daniel's going to disappear. And that's it. So, you know, what do we do with that? Well, take a look at source number 6, where I did bring you a Midrash, which tries to give us something. It talks about, this is a Midrash about Noach, and it's really based on Psukim in Noach, but it'll apply here. Ze echad mishlosha shera'u gimel olamos. This, meaning Daniel, is one of three people who saw three worlds. Noach, Daniel, and Iyov. What do you mean by three worlds? Noach ra'a olam b'yishuvo, ra'a b'churbano b'chazav ra'a b'yishuvo. Noach sees pre-flood, during the flood, and then after. Three different worlds. Daniel also, Ra'a Binyan Bayis Rishon, he sees the first Beis HaMikdash. V'ra'ahu Chareisua destroyed, V'chazar V'ra'ahu Banoi B'Binyan Bayis Sheni. And as this Medrash says it, Daniel lives to see the second Beis HaMikdash. Which, you know, if you think of the period between the two Beis HaMikdash as 70 years, it's doable. And in fact, the Nevi'im described people who saw the first and saw the second and said, the second doesn't match up to what we had in the first. The second is nothing compared to it. They cried and so on. If you look at the Nevi'im Haggai and Zechariah, you get nice records of that. So according to this, he at least survives to see the second Beis HaMikdash. Ibn Ezra says that he's actually 15 years old at the start of the book. Now there's a key event that happens during this exile. That when we're first under the Babylonians and then under the Persians. It's an event that we celebrate. Purim. Right. Purim happens during this. And the question then is, if Daniel lives through Purim, where is he? Like, how do you have somebody who was so important that he was part of the royal court, not just under the Babylonians, but under the Persians also? And how does he disappear? Which leads to a Gemara you may be familiar with, which identifies Daniel with. Anybody know? Hatach. Right. Hatach. You have three people who you could play with there. Harvona, Hege, and Hatach. So Hatach is the one that people identify with Daniel. Hatach they associate with Lachtoch, to cut. And the Gemara says that all of the decrees were set at his word. Were cut. Hatach, Lachtoch, and his word.
court.
So according to that Gemara, he actually is in Ahasuerus's court as well, although Ahasuerus will not show up in this book. Yeah. But they're trying to figure out what in the world happened to Daniel. Now, there are a few other things to note. I'm just debating because we also want to see some of the Sefer today, probably. This is all part of, as I said in the very beginning, I want feedback on the format, like to know whether people want to spend more on the Sefer, more on the discussion, and so on. So hopefully, when I send out my email asking for feedback afterwards, you'll let me know something of what you're looking for in the series. But Yechezkel actually mentions a righteous person named, we think, Daniel. You know, I'm looking to see how many people have a Tanakh. So there are a couple of Tanakhs on the table. If you take a look at Yechezkel, Yud-Dalet, if so, whoever finds it first could read it out. It's the verse I mentioned in source number 7. I didn't actually bring it on the sheet. 14, yeah.
Okay. In English, or
in English, why not?
So 14.
Yeah.
Ben, even if he's three men, Ben, Smith, Noah, Daniel, and Leo. Then by the righteous.
You heard that?
Yeah. No.
Oh. Okay. Catch that again. Sorry, again, Alina.
Okay. Then even if these three men would be in its midst, Noah, Daniel, and Leo, then by their righteousness would save only their own souls. The right. World of the Lord shall.
Perfect.
Same three people.
Well, it sounds like it, doesn't it? Yechezkel mentions three people. He's describing a city and talking about a city in which everybody is evil, but there are righteous people in the city and their merit saving the city. And he mentions three people, which sounded like the same list as in this Midrash, right? Noach, Daniel, and Iyov. Well, that's a really funny list for Daniel to appear on. And this Midrash is without question using that pasuk. Right, there's no question this Medrash is familiar with the pasuk and, in fact, reading from it. But which one of these is not like the other? In the list of Daniel, well, chronologically, Noah.
Yeah.
Why is Yob not like him?
What was the world he saw before and after?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if I read the entire Medrash before, but Yob was when he was flourishing, then he was destroyed, and then God gives him. Nice presence at the end.
His own personal world.
Okay.
Well, Noah, timeline-wise,
in the sense that he's much earlier than everybody else. Doesn't have his own book.
He might
not
be
Jewish, but
part of
that. Wait, one second.
Oh, Eov's not Jewish, necessarily.
Eov is not necessarily Jewish.
He's Noah.
Noah is not necessarily Jewish. Well, Noah is not Jewish.
He's not Jewish, yeah.
What about Daniel? So here's an interesting thing. Alina, you found the pasuk. Anybody else who found the pasuk? How is Daniel spelled in that that pasuk?
Right. So in English it's Daniel, but it's Daniel.
It's Daniel in the Hebrew. It's not Daniel. It's Daniel. Dalid Nun Aleph Lamed. And in fact, Ugaritic legend, we're talking about ancient Near East, talks about a righteous person, an ancient righteous person who would not be Jewish, whose name was Daniel. So that it's very possible Yechezkel is not even referring to Daniel, because why would you put him in a list with Iov, who is very likely not Jewish within that story, although there's, you can spend time discussing that, and Noah, who clearly is not. It makes a lot more sense for him to actually be Daniel, and therefore Daniel is not mentioned in Yechezkel, which also makes a lot of sense, because Yechezkel is a Navi between the two Batei Mikdash, between the two temples, but really in the beginning. When Daniel is still a 15-year-old kid, and people would not really have known him. So it's odd to think that Yechezkel is mentioning Daniel by name. It's far more likely he's mentioning this other fellow, Daniel, rather than mentioning Daniel. But in terms of Daniel himself...
But then the Medrash comes and takes it as...
But the Medrash takes it anyway, correct. Because the Medrash looks at it and says, well, there are common denominators between them. It fits with some of the psukim regarding Noah to describe him as seeing three worlds, and that's what this Medrash is really picking up on. It's much more about Noah than the others, but then it sees the similarities between them and uses all three. That's not uncommon for Medrash to do. In the same way that we have Midrashim, which will say, Hatach is Daniel, where there's a lot less evidence to work with. In terms of Daniel, we're going to see Daniel clearly as righteous, and that's going to come up in the very beginning with his very first encounter that we're going to see in the first parak, in which the king is going to try to feed him food from the king's table, and at peril of his life, Daniel is going to refuse it. for reasons we have to discuss. The Midrash amplifies more on this. I think I brought on the sheet, I brought you a few Midrashim that describe what it was that he was known for. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it right now, but you have a Gemara in source number 8, which is talking about who Mashiach should be like. And they say, if Mashiach is like the living, he should be like Rabbeinu HaKadosh, who canonized the Mishnah. If Mashiach is like those who have passed away already, Mashiach is going to be like Daniel. Which, you know, why is it supposed to be like Daniel is a good question. Again, I want to spend a lot of time talking about Daniel. I want you to read the book. But that tells you the esteem in which they held him. Similarly, the Midrash in number 9 talks about how he took care of everybody. In number 11, it speaks of the Jews gathering to be consoled by Daniel when they are in exile. He evolves through the book. In the first half of the book, he is a sage, an interpreter of dreams, and in the second half, he is a visionary. In the first half of the Sefer, he uses his own intellect to figure things out. In the second half, angels come to him and explain things. His contact with the angels changes in the book as well. In the beginning, they're like his servants saving him from harm, and then later they become like his teachers, who are actually explaining visions to him. One of the debates that surround Daniel is the question of whether he's a Navi. Is Daniel a Navi? Any strong feelings one way or the other?
Yes. If he has a book named after him, isn't
it? Well, if you get a book, you must be a Navi. Well, is that true?
My angels can explain things.
Yeah. Yeah. Angels explain things. Is it? What's the definition of a Navi?
Well, he talks about
the future. His book is in the wrong section of Tanakh. Right? How did he end up in the Ksuvim section if he is a Navi? Ksuvim, the writings. So, really, no. Triassar is a Navi. Triassar is the end of Navi. Dirayam is Ezra Nehemiah. Dirayam is Ezra. Is Ezra really writing the history of the Jews? Ezra is assumed not to be a Navi. He's many things, but a Navi he's not.
Nope.
Daniel is not considered. There are those who disagree because, you know, we're Jews and why not? But generally speaking, it is assumed that Daniel is not a Navi. Well, now you have to ask. Well, he got his own book. You know, in the wrong section or the right section. Right. But he spoke about the future. Angels, you know, explained visions to him. What does it take to be a Navi? You think he got that far, why not just give him a title? So the question really, I think, goes back to the root of the word Navi. What does the word come from? Niv, which is? Right, Niv Svatayim, good. Speech or mouth. He's somebody who speaks. The Navi is supposed to convey a message. The other etymology that's given for Navi is Lehavi, to bring. Someone who also is carrying something. Meaning God gives him a message and says, tell it to the people. It's often not about the future. Right? When you think about the bulk of Nevuah in Tanakh, the bulk of prophecy, it's not, this is what's going to happen in the future. It tends to be, this is what you're doing wrong, and here's how you correct it. Or, this will happen to you in the future. But, generally speaking, the Nevi'im are not telling you, this is what's going to be in the future at all. Daniel, in the book itself, notwithstanding the Midrash that I brought you in number 10 about the people listening to him, nonetheless, Daniel in the book never addresses the Jews, and never conveys a message. When the Malachim come to him, they do not tell him, tell the people, just the opposite. He's actually told at the end of the book, seal this so that nobody will understand it, which he did really well. Maybe that's why it's in Aramaic. No, Daniel is not a Navi, according to again, most views, because he's not told to take a message to the people. You can see on the sheet I brought you in number 11, the four arguments. Number 1, he is called a Chacham in the Gemara. Source number 12 is the source where he is called a Chacham, a sage. He's not called a Navi. They distinguish specifically between him and others. For he was not a Navi. He was not a prophet, and yet he saw things that prophets did not. That's one argument. Number 2, he's never told to convey a message to the people. Number 3, he says nothing to improve the people. He never tells the Jews, do this, and now you'll be better. And number four, he has no conversations with God. There, he gets a vision and an explanation, but there are no conversations, which we think of as characterizing the Navi. Now, you know, if we wanted to spend more time on this point, the question is really overall, what's the purpose of a Navi? Why does God ever speak to human beings? What's he trying to accomplish? And why doesn't he speak to Daniel? Abarbanel never feels like he has to toe the party line. Really, there are two people who you will read as commentators on Tanakh who you can rely upon to run counter to what everybody else is saying. And one is Abarbanel, and the other is Avraham Ibn Ezra. And both of them say he's a Navi. Just like you can predict it, you know, that they're both going to say that. Abarbanel says, sure he is. If you take a look at number 14, he says, Umihu ze ve'ezehu mehanevi'em ha'mefursamim ba'umah. Sharo'u mar'os alokim ka'elev v'yodiyu asidos mufla'os la'alafim me'ashanim k'daniel. He says, who has visions like these about things happening thousands of years in the future? Like Daniel. Of course he's a Navi.
Maybe he translates Navi differently. Maybe he's using it as a real term, as a prophet. That if you're prophesying, you're a Navi. Not if you're a messenger of God. Mm-hmm. As another way of translating that.
Good. So maybe the answer is that he has a broader or different explanation of what Navi is, and therefore it doesn't matter that it's not to convey it to the people. That's indeed possible. There are debates between the Rambam and Abarbanel, not in the same time, obviously, but about the definition of Navi for other purposes, too. Rambam believes that you only become a Navi if you become the highest of spiritual people, to tap into what God's wavelength is. Whereas Abarbanel's view is that that's not true. Abarbanel says, God can send a message to whoever he wants. And so, to give an example, Hagar, right, the mother of Ishmael, in the Rambam's view, is not a Nevi'ah. She happens to have a dream in which a Malach is speaking to her. Abarbanel says, no, she's a Navi, because a Malach spoke to her. So, very different views in general of how Nevuah works. Between Abarbanel and others. So yeah, it's entirely possible. By the way, if you look at number 14, the heading there, Abarbanel's commentary to Daniel is called Ma'ayinei HaYeshua. Ma'ayinei HaYeshua means springs of salvation, right? It's a poetic name, it's nice. His commentaries to the other books don't get special names. Like Malbim, each of the commentaries he has to a Sefer has its own name. Abarbanel doesn't, but with Daniel he does, because Abarbanel believes that Daniel is predicting the ultimate redemption of the Jewish people in his own time. Abarbanel went so far as to predict Mashiach was going to come in the year 1503, based on the calculations seen at the end of Sefer Daniel, which is huge, because the people in his day, suffering from the expulsion, and not just the expulsion from Spain, but the general Inquisition, which is far broader than Spain, and the other expulsions they go through, because it's not the only one. We were expelled from every country at least once in Europe. To him, this is a message of hope for the people. And so he calls his commentary on Daniel the springs of salvation. Like, this is it. This is where you can see it. And maybe that's also why it's really important to Abarbanel that Daniel be a Navi. This is not just what some scholar wrote. This is a Navi speaking. And of course, when 1503 comes and goes, and there's no Mashiach, then he says, oh wait, I miscounted, and he goes back through it and shows you it could be 1504. And that doesn't happen, and he goes to 1505. And when that doesn't happen, he says, you know, forget it. Maybe I'm better off not giving numbers. But Abarbanel and Ibn Ezra both call him a Navi. One other point of background, and then we'll go further with this and actually get into the Sefer. Daniel is not the only Jew in Tanakh to be a member of the king's court. Who else is? Yosef and Esther. Oh, right, I put it as number 15, sorry. Mordechai less so. Mordechai is outside the court until after the danger is passed, and then he becomes the second in command. He takes over for Haman. But initially, Mordechai is the outsider. Esther is the one in the court. And all three of them are put in positions to help the Jews, right? Yosef when the brothers come down, Esther obviously, and Daniel, as we'll see in the Sefer itself. And all three of them are put in positions to help the government. Where does Yosef have the chance to help the government? With the food, right? Where's Esther's opportunity to help the government? Bigdan and Teresh, right? The plot against Achashverosh. And Daniel, we're going to see, also has a big chance to help Achashverosh. And all three of them do it. Even though the people they're dealing with, well, we don't know much about Yosef's power at that stage in the story, so maybe I can't speak about Yosef and power, although the fact that he says off with his head to the baker doesn't bias me in his favor. But in terms of Achashverosh, he's a terrible human being. And certainly not someone we're a fan of. Even when you just read the Megillah, before you even get into the Midrash and the Gemara and its explanations of his stance via the Jews, and the fact that, oh, by the way, he lets Haman destroy them, right? Achashverosh is not a good guy. It would have been very easy to just let the plot go through. And Daniel is going to help Nebuchadnezzar, who is one of the worst human beings who ever lived from a Jewish perspective. I mean, destroyer of the Beis HaMikdash, murderer of thousands, the last guy you ever want to save. And yet Daniel's going to save him. And the Gemara is going to condemn him for it, interestingly. I'm like blowing the ending here, I'm sorry. But the point is that there are parallels in these stories and lessons to be learned across Tanakh in terms of how we conduct ourselves. She's upset, she wants to be at the shir. I don't blame her. We also will see that the Midrash will pick up on this and carry elements from one story to another story. And we're going to see that very clearly in the first parak. So let's take a look at actually starting. We'll get something in so that we don't say that we sat here without actually seeing Daniel. Bishnas Shalosh L'Malchus Yehoyakim Melech Yehuda. The third year of King Yehoyakim of Yehuda, that southern kingdom that I mentioned before, Bat Nebuchadnezzar, it's actually written as Nebuchadnezzar in the Tanakh, but don't get hung up on it. Melech Bavel, Yerushalayim Vayotzar Aleha. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, lays siege to Yerushalayim. That's how we start. Now, there's actually a lot of discussion about this and whose third year it is and all that, but I don't want to get into too much of the history and the chronology. There are big problems because Nebuchadnezzar cannot possibly have done this in the third year of Yehoyakim because he doesn't become king until the fourth year of Yehoyakim. So there's a lot of discussion in the commentaries who try to figure it out. Ibn Ezra, Seder Olam, Abarbanel, Rashi. But if people really want to know the history, we can always come back to it next week. Right now, we're going to see the book itself. Vayitain Hashem biyado es Yehoyakim melech Yehuda. So God gives to Yehoyakim, He gives Yehoyakim to Nebuchadnezzar. Umiktas klei beis ha'elokim, as well as some of the vessels from the Beis HaMikdash. Vayivyeim eretz Shinar beis Elokav, and he brings them to the land of Shinar, which is another name for Babel. Shinar, you may be familiar with in a slightly different form. Sumeria, right? Also from that geographic location. So he brings them to Shinar, to his palace. Ves ha-kelim hevi, beis otzar lokav. And he took the kelim, the vessels, and he brought them to the storehouse of his God. Does that ring a bell at all? The vessels of the Beis HaMikdash? Kelim ha-kelim shamim, good, yeah.
And eating from them too.
Right, use of these vessels at Achashverosh's party. Now, all the Megillah says is that at the party he had kelim and mikelim shonim, different types of kelim, which the Gemara reads and says, what are you talking about? What does that mean? Achashverosh had kelim of different kinds, vessels of different kinds. Why are you mentioning that in the Megillah alongside the fact that he had, you know, enough wine for everybody to drink and then some? And you describe the beautiful decor, and he had mismatched kelim. Like, that's what you're trying to tell me about Achashverosh. And so the Gemara says, no, those are the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. Where does the Gemara get that idea from? I mean, the pasuk is strange. Where do you get that as the answer? Flip ahead for a second to Perek Hei Pasuk Bet, chapter 5, sentence 2. The feast of Belshazzar. Belshazzar, king after Nebuchadnezzar. He makes a feast also. And Belshazzar Amar b'te'im chamra lahisa l'manei daba l'chaspa dihanpik Nebuchadnezzar avui min hechla di b'Yerushalayim. Belshazzar, having had a little to drink, tells them to bring the vessels of gold and silver which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the palace in Yerushalayim. V'yishtun v'hon, Malkov rav rifonohi, sheglasei lochenasei. And everybody, the king, his officers, their wives, everybody's going to drink from those kelim. So Achashverosh, who in fact takes over when the Persians take over from the Babylonians, it isn't a direct sequence, but it's close to it, from Belshazzar, is pictured as doing exactly what Belshazzar did. That's the precedent for the idea. But it also points to something very interesting about Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't do that. Right? He puts it in the place of his God. Nebuchadnezzar, as horrible as he is not the worst that Babylon will have to offer. It's going to get worse. He has a certain respect. It's still, I mean, he takes them as trophies, fundamentally. He's not worshipping them. But he has a certain respect for it that he's not going to put it out at his feast. You follow? So that's just an interesting thing that Nebuchadnezzar does with it. And there's more to be said about it, because we also took certain vessels from people we captured. David took the vessels of the Moabite gods, and then the question is, what exactly did he do with them? But it's not unique to them taking this from us. It's something we did too. It was a sign of our God beat your God, is more or less what's involved. We reject your idolatry by taking it as a trophy. Also worth noting, these vessels have a separate importance. I'm just debating whether to open the Tanakh to see it. There are a few Tanakhs around. But in Yirmiyahu, in Perikhav Zion, chapter 27, we're going to see that some vessels remain, but ultimately they're taken into Galus with King Yehoyachin. But we are told regarding the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, the vessels of the temple, Bavela Yuv'u Vishama Yihyu. They will be taken to Babel, and they're going to stay there until God decides to bring them back. Incidentally, that pasuk gets taken a little bit out of context as the basis for a lot of anti-Zionism, because the Gemara at the end of Ksuvah says that that's a reference not just to the vessels, but to us. You're not supposed to go back to Zion until God brings you back. To which the response is, number one, that's the first temple, not the second. Right? It's not after the destruction of the second. And also that there are sources within the Gemara that lead you to the opposite conclusion. It's not the only source on the table. But that verse says, the kelim, the vessels, represent your exile. So when Nebuchadnezzar takes them and puts them in this, wherever he's keeping his trophy chest for his, kelim from other gods, it's a statement of the Jews are now in exile, and they're going to make a big deal out of it in Ezra, in the first Perek, when they come back, because Cyrus, the Persian king, is going to officially send the Kalim back. So that represents our ability to return for the second temple, the second Beis HaMikdash. And, it's like an arc closing, where it started in Yirmiyah and Malachim, where the vessels were taken. It continued in Daniel, with Nebuchadnezzar putting them in his treasure chest. It continues with Belshazzar and Ahasuerus, the ultimate in our degradation, as the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash are used for this, feast, for them to just drink. And then Koresh returns them to build the second Beis HaMikdash. But you have to know a lot of books in order to see that. So hopefully that's something to gain here. So he takes them to Shinar, which, as I mentioned, is Sumer, which is Lower Mesopotamia, and so on. Okay. Now, I don't know, but I think I'm out of time.
I think some people need to...
Okay. So, we're going to stop with that.